This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Paul DeAngelis. He's the co-author of a book called Dear Mrs. Kennedy, The World Shares Its Grief. The World Shares Its Grief, Letters, November 1963. Paul, how are you?
I'm fine. Doing well this morning.
Yeah, me too. So this is a pretty interesting book. It's a collection of the letters that, well, not all of the letters, but a selection.
There were 1,300,000 or so of them, so right. we decided not to put them all together.
Would have made a fairly large book, although nowadays you could do a website with them. But what you've done is, the scene is set by, in 1963, after the assassination of President Kennedy, there was this upwelling of grief nationally and internationally. And I hadn't actually thought about this, but of course it produced letters that were written primarily to Mrs. Kennedy as condolence letters.
Yeah, it was an amazing event. I mean, it was really the defining moment of my generation anyway, and I think of also, I'm not going to say it was a defining event of my parents' generation, because that was really Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th. But for really the baby boom generation, I mean, until 9/11, it was sort of the event that everyone experienced, and you would go around like, what were you doing that day? And so, I mean, when I was first approached about, well, maybe you want to go ask questions.
No, that's right. You can go ahead. I mean, I guess the first question was, how did you come to be involved in this project?
Right. Well, that's actually what I was just going to go into. I got into it because I had ghostwritten a book on American history that was sort of related to this subject. And the book was originally, the idea for the book came to Jay Mulvaney, an author who had written several books, including a best-selling book about the Kennedys called Kennedy Weddings. He'd also written an unorthodox biography of Jackie Kennedy paired with Diana, Princess Di. He had in doing his research, a lot of research at the Kennedy Library, and he had also worked for Teddy Kennedy at one point. He was aware of this condolence collection, and was also aware that they had never really, no one had really ever looked at them in any serious way. And it was just a huge, huge collection that, even though it's actually much diminished from what the original one was, but it's still very huge up at the Kennedy Library. And he convinced St. Martin's Press to do a collection. The amazing thing about these letters is they came from every walk of life, from ordinary people, but also from the most famous people. It's like a who's who of anybody who was anybody in 1963. Just going through these letters, everyone you ever heard of was in there. Even, Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, Vivian Lee, the widow of Clark Gable.
Right, and of
we
course
didn't have people from the dead. But some people who you wouldn't really even expect to still be alive. I mean, Sergeant York sent something, the World War I hero. It was just amazing. He had signed up this book and had started work on it, did a selection of about 1,000 letters, the first selection, cleared a few dozen, and then unfortunately he had a heart attack and died in the spring of 2008, a few months after he had started work on the book. I was brought in, I was contacted a couple months after that, could I take it over? And at first I was sort of, when they approached me, I thought, oh no, not another Kennedy book. But when I saw the material and started reading some letters, and found that I was, it just brought back everything, of that period of what I remember, and yet was novel, there's something about looking at it 50 years later that makes a tremendous difference.
What you've done with the book is the letters are there, but you have text that you've written. I assume that's you or...
Yeah, it was me. I mean, there are a few words that Jay had come up with, but he had written very little. Actually, yeah.
Right. So, in a sense, what you do is you get to tell the history of that period through the lens of the letters. And, you know, you've got a lot of, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of information. You know, I lived through that period myself, and there I learned, it maybe brought back things that I hadn't thought of in 40 or 50 years.
Absolutely.
But, it also is a kind of history lesson in told in this kind of, you know, a pretty easygoing way. So it's not scholarly, but it gives you the opportunity to talk about a lot of the issues of the day, things that were important then, you know, a kind of fabric of the world at that time.
Right, and it's all united by this common concern about this common loss, which is, so it unites all these different people who, you know, otherwise have nothing in common are somehow all brought together in this moment. And that is, so there's a sort of, there's a constant refrain that it's like incredibly broad, and yet it's all unified by this one moment. It's sort of, I was thinking of it when I started doing it, you know, and putting it together. It reminded me of some of those photographic books, you know, of a day in the life of the world or something, I think, that they've done where they took a photograph of all around the world in different places. And that was the other amazing thing about John F. Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy. They were such world citizens, and they were so admired all around the world. I mean, yes, the United States was hugely important, but, you know, here was a United States president who represented youth and vigor, and it finally seemed like, you know, the hopes of the world were pinned on him, and the response around the world was just incredible. I mean, you know, letters from everywhere and every language, and it was helped by, you know, the fact that Jackie was fluent in French and knew some Spanish and had a lot of Italian friends and had traveled to India. And Jack, you know, had this whole Irish connection. What was fascinating about that too, I mean, that is something that I hadn't been as aware of. The Jack was really raised by his father to try to be, you know, to make it into the WASP establishment, in the New England WASP establishment, and breaking barriers as an Irish Catholic, and he broke barriers, you know, being the first Catholic elected and stuff like that. But he was, because of that, he was sort of groomed not to be an Irishman, you know. I mean, he had to sort of rediscover his roots in Boston later, because he basically grew up in you know, except for his very young youth and the time he spent at Cape Cod, he wasn't a Boston creature, although his first few years were in Brookline. He was mostly from his elementary and his middle school years was in Riverdale, at the Riverdale School, and then he was at Choate, and then he was at Harvard. And so he was really raised to be part of the sort of WASP establishment. And when he'd rarely been to Ireland. And while he was in office, he wanted to go back. And in 1963, in June, he took this trip to sort of rediscover his roots as President of the United States. And it was an amazing, amazing trip to sort of, I read a lot about that. And there were so many letters from his relatives and people from Ireland, you know, and condolence letters to Jackie, that, you know, and Jackie did not go on that trip. That was really his trip, rather than, that it was also fascinating to just see the relationship between Jack and Jackie that emerges through these, you know, through these letters. Anyway, I just found it a fascinating trip down memory lane, and also, it made me think of how things have changed and how, what a different world it was. You know, I think we all think of Jack Kennedy sort of starting the 60s, and so there's some association with the craziness of that decade. But when you get back into these letters, you realize how long ago it was, and how, you know, even the Beatles hadn't even been on the Ed Sullivan Show yet. You know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all of this history of the you know, Bob Dylan was just beginning to get known. Things were just, it was just the cusp. It was such a turning point in 1963 when he died. It sort of, it lent a sort of a meaning. I mean, it, in a way, it was the first violent moment of the 60s, and yet it was you see in all some of these letters so many people who are pledging themselves to carry out this vision, to overcome this moment of violence. And of course, you know, it didn't quite work out that way. But
no, but I think at the time you have to sort of, as you say, you have to remember what that era was like. The early '60s were, under Kennedy, a you know, kind of psychologically uplifting for people who had felt that, you know, the 50s had been kind of complacent and, you know, America was self-involved and
complacent, conservative, and nothing but frozen food.
Yeah, I mean, it was, but you know, it was the early 60s are still part and parcel of that other era.
Right.
You know, it wasn't that the people who were following Kennedy's vision of what America could be were in fact counterculturalist, and they weren't.
No,
that came much later, and that has actually almost nothing to do with Kennedy and his world or Jackie and her world.
Right.
They were very socially conservative.
Oh yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, that shows in the book as well.
Yeah.
You know, but Kennedy was not. I mean, it's sort of interesting. I thought about for people who are alive today, trying to understand what it was like then is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And this book may help because it brings you into that era in a certain way. But I think, you know, for younger people today, maybe you think of Obama as the equivalent
right.
to Kennedy. And then there are some really interesting comparatives there in terms of who Kennedy really was, even though he was this younger guy speaking about change. He wasn't calling for a radical change in the way America operates. He was calling for a change.
and the forces of change were pushing him rather than him pushing the change.
Right, I agree. So, you do have a pretty broad selection of letters. And, you know, one of the things that I think you did a really good job of is avoiding what could be the repetitiousness of the condolence letter form, because obviously when you're printing so many of them, and how many things can one say in those circumstances?
Oh, it was something, you know, when you're sitting there in the library going through these letters and, you know, and you're sitting through one after another, said, you know, it's the will of God or it's this or, it's, or you know, it's this, the you cannot imagine the repetitions of the phrases, which is so natural, of course, because how many ways can you say the same thing?
That's
and
right.
It's so easy to have your eyes glaze over.
Oh, I can imagine. Now, how you said that there are fewer now of the letters than there were. How many were there in the first place, and why are there fewer now?
Well, there were about 800,000 were sent up until the time that they sent out acknowledgement cards. There were hundreds of thousands were sent in December, you know, in late November, early December, January of 1963 into early 1964. Jackie Kennedy went on television on January, I think it's 15th or 16th, 1964, along with Bobby and Teddy. She was she went on television and thanked the American people for sending all these condolence cards, these condolence letters, and saying that they would all be acknowledged and that they would go into the new Kennedy Library that was being planned to be on the banks of the Charles River. Well, it didn't end up being on the banks of the Charles River, but it did end up being in Boston. Because she appeared on television saying they'd all be acknowledged, that started a whole new wave of condolence letters that came. I think people love the idea of being acknowledged by Jackie Kennedy. So finally, all of these were being handled, the condolence letters, because this huge volume of mail was being handled by Nancy Tuckerman, her social secretary, and a little bit by Pamela Turner, who was an appointment secretary for Jackie. They had organized a group of volunteers and they were just, it was overwhelming, but you know, they had to farm things out, but they did manage to classify the letters, to pull out the ones from VIPs, and it wasn't easy to figure out in the chaos of all that, you know, which was an important letter, especially since if somebody was close to Jackie, they would write with less identification of who they are, and they weren't writing it on, you know, people who were writing in a formal capacity wrote it on formal paper, but people who maybe had been close or famous people, you know, might write on a first name basis and might write on their personal stationery, you know, and they had to find these things, you know, because it was critically important that she acknowledge the people who were actually close to her in some way. So it was an amazing, just technical feat to be able to gather these letters. Finally, they decided that they would have to at some point put a sort of draw a line in the sand. So at this point, we will acknowledge, and after this, we won't. And so in March of 1964, they sent out acknowledgement cards to 800,000 people. They had that much mail by then.
That's an amazing number just by itself.
This is before databases, you know. I mean,
right.
In fact, the zip code, one of the fascinating things I discovered was then I realized is the zip code had just been introduced as a concept, about 3 months earlier. And so there were no zip codes on any of these letters. You know, they were the old, sometimes you'd have a postal code, and often you would just have, you know, Cleveland, Ohio. Nothing to expedite the, you know, what we're so used to today. So anyway, and then the condolence letters continued to grow in the year after, and of course there was another surge on the anniversary in 64, and they continued. Basically, they stopped collecting them in 65, except for some rare things, and they consolidated some letters. Some condolence letters had gone to the senior Kennedy, some had gone to Bobby Kennedy. A lot of them were sort of centralized in the condolence mail to Jackie Kennedy. And at this point, the Kennedy family was involved in raising the funds to create the Kennedy Library, and that ran into some difficulties. There were some questions about, originally the library was going to be part of near Harvard or part of Harvard on the Charles River in Cambridge, but there was opposition there from the neighborhood, so finally it took a long time. They finally moved it to the South Boston area, where it is now Columbia Point. And so it took about 15 years before they actually had the building, and everything had to be in storage. While things were in storage, some things were damaged because they were in a warehouse that had a leak. And so some things were just damaged, some of these letters. Luckily, not the quote VIP letters, but, unluckily, a lot of other letters, which might have been very, very interesting. And then there was a curatorial decision by a consultant, a head archivist who brought in a consultant who, I guess this was in the 1983, and there was this big idea that, you know, everything should be culled scientifically, and there was no interest at that point in really anybody looking at these letters, and so they decided to sort of randomly just throw out a majority of the letters and to keep like 1 in 10 or something of the regular letters and the regular people. Some of the archivists who worked there, including the head archivist who was there until recently, Alan Goodrich, were opposed to this, and they tried to fight it because they thought that, you know, who knows, in 20 years we might, you know, really want this record of mass humanity, this sort of massive response. But they lost, and a lot of the records were just thrown out, culled, quote, scientifically, although some, you can never really be scientific about that. So anyway, the collection now is around 250,000, or maybe 205,000. It's still a huge collection, and it's only partially cataloged in a real way. But that's sort of what happened.
So, and of the letters, I mean, how many could you have read? It's just kind of a daunting task. How many did you read?
Well, I think I read probably around 10,000 or so.
That's a lot of letters.
I mean, and I wouldn't claim to have actually read every word of every one of those, but there are VIP letters, there are memories, and then there are adult and children, and of course there are a lot of letters in foreign languages. I went into some of those that I had some knowledge of the language, and looked through and sampled, but you can't. It really, you know, it would be a fascinating project to really, you know, to have some scholars and really try to really excavate the entire collection. But that is just a huge, you know, huge project, and it does, as I said, it's numbing because there is a similarity of a lot of this, and most of the letters are handwritten, not all of them, but it's not always easy to make things out. But it's such a, when you come across something that is extraordinary, I mean, at one point I remember in the memory section, of which, you know, you think in the memories you're going to have people who have real memories of Jackie, of Jack and Jackie. Well, you do, but what you do is you find you that everybody who ever attended a political rally has a memory of seeing Jack. And there are hundreds of thousands, you forget the politicians, their career is to meet people. And so they have met a huge number of people. And a lot of these people wrote. So finding in that mass, I remember at some point I was looking through and I saw this letter that the handwriting was so tiny. It was almost like little lines, you know, you could almost, there was hardly any variation going up and down. But and it was something attracted me about it, so I started looking at it, and I started reading it, and realized this was a letter from a neighbor from Brookline who had been a little girl. Her name was Esther Edwards, and she'd been a little girl at the time, growing up next to Joe Kennedy, Jack's older brother, and Jack. And she remembered being sort of captured. They played war together, sort of. And she remembered being captured and being locked in their garage and sneaking out. And she these wonderful little memories. And it turned out later, she also went to Hyannisport and she met them there and she had some connection with them. And she wrote this incredible letter about her memories as a child of Jack, and his sort of martial and aggressive spirit, and how she first felt when he ran for president that she was worried that, you know, he would be a big saber rattler. But then she realized, as she watched him, that he had matured and he had strength, but it had been tempered by. Anyway, it's a wonderfully articulate letter based on you know, this childhood memory of somebody who had no political connection, no connection being an important person or something, but somehow saw through the nature of who the nature of this man was. And I found there were several letters like that I just found extraordinary to run across.
Well, of course, clearly for everyone who met him after he died, the memory becomes more cherished and also more developed, kind of.
Oh, right.
Kind of natural human
right.
thing to do. But I thought that, you know, the selection that you presented, I mean, you divided it up into different categories. So you've got people who knew him well, and you've got the political allies, the political foes.
Right.
You know, you have the journalists of the time writing about him.
Right.
And as you say, I'm sure this is true of any politician today as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also that era is different. You know, that people were educated, raised, and trained in writing differently, I think, than today.
Right.
Letter writing was certainly, you know, I know people have talked about letter writing as a lost art, but in many ways
mm-hmm.
it is. I mean, the number of people who know how to put together a good formal condolence letter probably
right.
is reduced today. So what you've got also is, in many cases, when you have the heads of state or well-known people, chances are good that they had help with the writing.
Right.
You know, with
right.
Khrushchev, you would assume mm-hmm. when he writes, he's writing with someone there helping him with the English.
Yeah, I don't know. No, he wrote in Russian.
Oh, okay.
That was translated.
Okay. Well, see,
he
yeah,
didn't
there...
try with the English.
Pardon
although,
me?
Although Nina, his wife, sent a little note in English.
Right, and clearly she wrote that herself.
Yeah, she wrote that herself.
But even if he wrote it in Russian, he's having help probably,
right.
Although one never knows. I mean, it's sort of
you know, it's actually, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, he really had this personal, he had with such a an incredible, there was a personal connection, even though they were really rivals, Kennedy and Khrushchev, there was this personal connection that was clearly very strong, and he was very upset by the death.
You can imagine that all of the people who were his opponents would be, in some ways, more upset. It's like when you have, you know, you have a respected opponent,
mm-hmm.
if something terrible happens to them, not only does that interrupt the flow of your work
mm-hmm.
and change the dynamic, but it also is sobering for anybody who's in political office. You know, they're thinking, well, that could happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, and they had worked out a modus vivendi, sort of how what was going to happen between you know, they had been through this confrontation about Cuba. They had come to a settlement about it, and it was also I think Khrushchev had given up a certain amount of face with the settlement in Cuba. You know, because even though even though he had gotten something in return from Kennedy, the removal of the U.S. missiles from Turkey, that was not publicly acknowledged by Kennedy ever. So it looked as if Khrushchev is the only one who had lost face, and that meant that the domestically Khrushchev was weakened unless he could get something else out of Kennedy, and they had gotten something out of Kennedy. They had gotten a nuclear arms. The world had gotten something. The nuclear arms treaty had been passed. What we're doing now with the nuclear arms treaty that we're trying to do with Iran, all was the Kennedy Khrushchev meeting after Cuba, where they decided they had to do something to avert the kind of near Holocaust that could have been created by the Cuba crisis. You know, if bombs had really gone out.
That's true.
It forged
their relationship between. Well, and he must have had that with many other people as well, because you can tell from these letters from other political figures, international and domestic, how powerful he was in terms of his relationship with these people.
Yeah.
I mean, he really was. You know, obviously now, having been shot and removed from the scene, he's become larger than life for all of us. Mm-hmm. But he probably really was, this very interesting and unusual guy with a tremendous force of character and great charisma. It shines through.
Right.
You know, I would imagine another president being shot who would have been, would have been as tragically treated by all, but maybe the personality of the person would have altered the nature of the condolences.
Well, one of the things I just read, there's a new book out actually called FDR's Funeral Train, which is based on the immediate aftermath of the death of FDR, which that wasn't an assassination, but it was still a shock. And of course, FDR was older, and it was pretty apparent he was in some ill health. But it was a very different kind of, and it happened right before victory in Europe in 1945. I mean, it was totally different circumstances. But it reminds you of what history is. That history, there are no circumstances that are alike. And I was also reminded of that death of FDR because one of the tributes that was paid to Kennedy from Carl Sandburg, Sandburg wanted his literary agent. Sandburg himself was very old, so he had it handled through his literary agent, who he wanted to send the poem that he had written about the death of FDR as a fitting tribute to Kennedy, which was in a way the highest tribute that could be paid to compare Kennedy, who after all only was there for 2.5 years or so, to FDR, who was the giant of the Democratic Party and of the hero of World War II. So it was sort of there was an explicit parallel drawn there.
So one thing I want to ask you is, out of all these letters and the ones that are in the book, do you have a favorite?
Well, I have several. I don't have a single favorite. I have several favorites. One of the ones that I really loved, which was one of the most articulate ones, was by this guy in New Haven, Richard Santoro. That he was sort of a bright young man, and he wrote. He actually wrote the letter to his sister, who sent it on to Jackie Kennedy. But
I remember that letter. It was actually beautiful.
Yeah. Dear Barbara, of all human conditions, surely reality is the most difficult to grasp. The statement, the president has been shot, is insane. It simply cannot come to pass that here in these civilized lands, a leader would be cut down by some obscure, rancorous assassin. But it did happen. And we must, beyond an irrational sense of personal loss, evaluate the enormous implications of this act of violence. And he goes on, and it's a whole philosophical treatise. I included a huge amount of it, and I had some very merciless readers, including my daughter, who is 22, and who knew very little about this period. I mean, she knew something. She'd done a little history, but she's not a specialist or anything. And she, she'd say, well, this guy is wonderful, but, you can't have too much of him.
Well, it is, we do need to have selectivity, I think. And I think you've done a great job in putting together this book. Mm-hmm. It's called Dear Mrs. Kennedy, The World Shares Its Grief, Letters, November 1963. Paul DeAngelis and Jay Mulvaney are the authors, but Paul DeAngelis is who I've been speaking to. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Paul.
Thank you.
And this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors.